It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, after a weekend of rising COVID-19 case numbers and stagnant hospitalization numbers, UPMC claimed that Allegheny County was seeing a less severe strain of the coronavirus. But new reporting investigating these claims suggests that might not be true. Sarah Simon is an investigative data reporter for Spotlight PA. Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Sarah, at the July 9th press conference, Graham Snyder, a doctor, medical director of infection prevention, said, quote, "You may have heard in the news that there's a dominant global strain, one that seems to transmit easier, but is less deadly," end quote. Continuing, "That's the strain we're detecting, and our data supports those characteristics." Do we know? Have you found out why he made those claims and the evidence that he was using?
So there's still a lot of questions as to why he made those claims. I don't have an answer to that. But what I do know is from reading the academic research that UPMC has provided to me when I asked them, you know, where is this coming from? What do those claims mean? Reading the research tells me that there's no evidence to back them up. There's still many questions about this mutated strain that's now become the dominant global strain of the coronavirus. We just don't have the evidence that it's either more or less severe.
So you looked at these studies. Did you ask them what you learned from those studies to respond to and even, shall we say, defend those claims?
Right. So, I mean, that was the first question I did. I asked UPMC. I reached out to their media relations office and I said, look, I'm curious to know where this is coming from. I'm not aware of any evidence. Is there something I'm missing? Where are these claims coming from? And they sent me a link to a study and I read the study and it finds that there's not evidence there. So I sent that back to UPMC media relations and I said, well, you know, here's what I'm finding from what you just sent. What am I missing here? They sent a second paper and same thing. The second paper says, quote, "Further studies will be necessary to determine the impact of this change on the nature and severity of COVID-19. So I sent that back to UPMC and I said, okay, here's what I'm seeing with this second paper that you've sent me. And I have not heard from them since. I've reached out multiple times for comment again to maybe there's something I'm missing. Maybe I misunderstood. But really what I found with talking with virologists, with epidemiologists, with others who have been kind of focused and paying attention, doing the scientific research on this mutated strain of the coronavirus, the evidence is really just not there, which calls into question why UPMC would be making these claims. I don't know why. I'm trying to get to the bottom of it. But what I do know from talking with the experts is that there is no scientific proof to back up what they're saying.
So does the current research say, though, that there is more than one strain of the virus?
Yeah, that seems to be pretty well established that as the virus, as time has gone on, there is this mutation. But what in fact that means, that's where the questions are.
As you well know, the number of COVID-19 cases in the Pittsburgh region has been surging in the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. Without a corresponding big jump in hospitalizations, have you learned of any other reasons why Pittsburgh might be seeing the high increase in cases, but not the corresponding hospitalizations?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of reasons and a lot of factors that could be contributing here. So as I write in my story, the simple explanation might just be time, right? It might be delays. We know it takes time for symptoms to develop. We know it takes time for people to schedule and get schedule a COVID-19 test and maybe even find a place that's able to perform the test. It takes time for labs to conduct the test and for the results to come back. It takes time for hospitals to fill up, and they skew our real-time view of the disease because we just don't have yet an accurate read of what's happening in the moment. Another explanation that many of the experts that I spoke with were you know, attributed as like a totally legitimate explanation, is that, you know, with the rising case numbers in young people, there are different it's just a different population of people who are now experiencing COVID-19 than what we saw a few months ago. And we don't really have, again, not a scientist, but this is my understanding, we don't really have a good sense yet of how young people are going to be affected by this disease.
Final quick question, Sarah, and that is this. Do you think that UPMC, do you expect them to respond to your request since the publication of your article?
I don't know. What I'll say is I hope they do, right? I think this is they have a huge platform. They have huge influence on kind of public health policy and perception in the state. I think this is an important conversation, and I hope they know that I'm interested in kind of getting to the bottom of it.
Sarah Simon is an investigative data reporter for Spotlight PA. Thanks for taking the time, Sarah.
Thanks so much.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. During the course of this pandemic, restaurants in the region have been shut down, except for takeout. Then after a few weeks of reopening, indoor dining was prohibited, and some have just shut down permanently. Hal B. Klein is Pittsburgh Magazine's dining critic. Hal, the Independent Restaurant Coalition reported last month that as many as 85% of independent restaurants would close permanently by the end of the year. Does that stun you?
That sounds like a high number, but it doesn't sound too far off of what it might be. I mean, I think it's as long as I've been doing this and as far as anyone I know remembers, the most challenging time for restaurants that there's ever been, in recent memory especially.
Pittsburgh has been trying to build a reputation as a good place for dining. Overall, how big of a hit has that effort taken, do you think?
One of the things that was really starting to happen in Pittsburgh was that people were coming from other cities to spend a weekend in Pittsburgh. And the reason that they were doing that, in part at least, was to go to all these great restaurants, right? So you'd have someone from Cleveland or Columbus or even New York or Toronto even say, hey, you know, I want to go somewhere for a 3-day weekend. I want to check somewhere else out. And, oh, I hear, you know, this Pittsburgh has these great museums, these great bridges, this great music scene, and there are all these restaurants that I want to know. And I think that was such a great draw to the city. And, you know, it will be again eventually, but I think it's going to take a while to build that again.
Mm-hmm. So how bad is it now in our area? We've lost several restaurants over the last few months, right?
Yeah, it's tough. And we've lost some great restaurants. I mean, we lost Spoon, which I think was one of the restaurants that prompted the resurgence of what happened with Pittsburgh dining over the last 10 years. Union Standard, a shining example of a new restaurant. You know, I think it was about 3 years old when it closed downtown. And then something as legendary as Alexander's Italian Bistro, which has been around, you know, for probably 40 years, that also closed. So you're seeing it really across the board, which I think it shows what a challenging time it is.
Mm-hmm. How much might it be about the overall difficulty of successfully operating a restaurant as compared to it's all because of the pandemic?
I mean, it's a factor of both. I think Pittsburgh restaurants were probably a little bit overextended prior to COVID happening. But I mean, there's no way to not say that COVID is responsible for a lot of these closings and a lot of just the stress that restaurants are going through. I mean, it's such a challenging time. And when you're working at a place where you've got outdoor at 50% capacity maximum and no indoor dining, you know, it's really hard to figure out ways to get through it.
So what are you hearing from the owners? You're in touch with them. What are their biggest problems, concerns right now? What are their big hurdles?
They want to do everything they can to make things safe. And I think people are understanding of that. At the same time, I think it's really hard for people because their business depends, you know, their entire business model depends on people that are coming in and having a good time. And that's something that really can't happen right now.
Do they think they're getting enough guidance, clear guidance, enforcement from the county?
There's some challenge of, you know, being able to open and then shut again and open a little bit more. And I think that's really tough. And I know that some people are frustrated. There isn't complete guidance on this, and I think that's what makes it really hard because the science is still developing about what's happening.
Did many get loans from the federal government through the Small Business Administration?
Some places did, but even the places that did, those are running out now. I think the best way to get through this, even if you want to be open and you want to serve people, is to not have the same financial worry and to have a package for independent restaurants so that they don't feel like they're forced to do things that might, they're not forced to make a choice between staying in business and caring about the greater public safety.
How in March, just as the shutdown went into effect, Bethany Zazula, executive chef at the very popular Whitfield in the Ace Hotel, told you she was taking things day by day. Now we're hearing rumblings that the Ace, that very hip hotel, popular hotel in East Liberty, could be shutting down soon. Are you hearing similar things?
I'm hearing similar things. I reached out and they haven't been able to confirm anything yet. I know that the staff has been laid off, and there's no plans to open immediately, but it would just be such a big loss for the city.
Yeah, the Whitfield is really a drawing card, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's a special place. I think this is what we're seeing without financial support is that places like that are in risk of shutting down and we're going to lose linchpins. And when you look at that neighborhood, it's, Whitfield is there and Spoon is a couple blocks away from that. And so you've lost two great restaurants in that neighborhood.
What other places might be in danger now, do you think?
I think all these places, if you look at restaurants that say have a 40 seat capacity indoors and no outdoor space, those places are in real trouble because they're not going to be able to turn things around in the same way. I think if you look at huge spaces, like there's no way that they're going to be able to pay for rent in that building, to pay for utilities in that building while they can't make any money. And then you're asking people working in restaurants to put themselves at risk. You're asking them to have to deal with, unruly guests and put themselves at risk again. So I think it just becomes this really challenging situation, especially for indoor dining.
How, what's going to help? What are the characteristics of an independent restaurant that will help it survive?
I think it's going to be a couple things. I think one, it's if you're a diner and you have a restaurant that you love or a couple restaurants that you love, make it a point to get takeout from those restaurants once or twice a week. Tip really well, even if you're getting takeout. I think those are things that can help. And operating safely, I think that's going to help. And then I think there needs to be some kind of financial package. If things continue the way they're going and there isn't, federal support specifically, but also state support and local support. I think we're going to see a lot more restaurants that we love closed in 6 months.
Hal B. Klein is Pittsburgh Magazine's dining critic. Thanks, Hal.
Thank you.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory. Rosie the Riveter.
Rosie the Riveter is the name that was given to thousands of women who went to work in factories here in Pittsburgh and across the country during World War II. They helped build planes, trucks, and tanks. They fought the war on the home front. May Cryer was a Rosie. She worked on an assembly line at Boeing that made B-17 and B-29 bombers. She's 94 now, and she's still on the job, working from her home in Levittown, about 25 miles from Philadelphia, sewing masks for another battle, the fight against COVID-19. She's also on a mission to have all the Rosies honored with a Congressional Gold Medal. May, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thank you, Kim. Same to talk to you, too.
May, I understand that the masks that you're making look like that famous red and white polka dot bandana that Rosie's wore in factories to keep their hair out of the machinery.
Kevin, that's the trademark of Rosie's Riveter. We had to wear the bandanas during World War II. Of course, we didn't wear polka dots at that time. Ken Miller made that famous. But we had to wear the bandanas. That was a must. And now we're wearing the mask.
Mm-hmm. So you want these masks to remind people of the contribution that women made during the war effort?
That's right. When I started, I just started making them for our neighbors and my family and friends. And somebody put it on Facebook. It's absolutely amazing. And it's the different people I'm getting from. I just got one from one of the universities that one of my great granddaughters graduated from. I don't charge for them, but people are starting to give me a postage, which I appreciate because I am putting out money for postage. And now just today, I'm running low on polka dot material, and I put it on Facebook, and you can't imagine how the people are responding to me. They're sending me polka dot material from all around. And I think it's just absolutely wonderful to put it out there to make people realize there's not many of us left anymore. Right now, we're walking history, if people would just ask us, whether a few of us are left, about our stories, because in a few years or so, we'll be just be a page in the history book.
Well, let's hear about your story briefly. During the war years, why did you want to become a Rosie?
We grew up in a small town. And, of course, when the war was declared, all of our young men enlisted immediately. As time went on, us women thought, you know, the men are gone, we'll go too. So my girlfriend, my sister, and I packed up and went to Seattle. We thought we'd just go to Seattle for the summer. We thought it'd be a lark, we'd just have fun for the summer. But the way it turned out, we loved it, and all three of us became Rosies. My sister's gone now, but my girlfriend still lives out there, and I'm on Facebook with her every day.
Well, you've been trying to gather support for legislation to honor all the Rosies with the Congressional Gold Medal. You were traveling around the country to help win support until the pandemic hit. So
I've been all over. It's really, I shouldn't say all over, so many places. I go to Florida quite often, and, of course, Oklahoma City, Seattle. We really did good with the House, and we ended up getting 293, I think it was, in the House, and they passed it unanimously. I thought it was just great, but we're having such a hard time with the Senate. We've only got like 20 senators and 9 Republicans signed on, and we need at least 60.
Well, this making of masks to fight the pandemic has kept you busy, obviously, during the pandemic. Do you see any similar sense of shared purpose or sacrifice today during the pandemic as you did during the war years?
Well, you're looking at it different than I do. I don't consider it a sacrifice. We did what we had to do during World War II, and I get annoyed when I hear these people say, it's annoying, I don't want to wear a mask. And I said, well, we didn't like to wear bandanas either, but we did. And we carried rivet guns and welding torches. I mean, a whole lot harder than what these young people are doing today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our country's good, so full of good people. But all we see anymore is the fights in the streets and destruction. And it's hard for us people of my age to understand that because we work so hard to, you know, for our country and our world. And I realized that. I was invited to Normandy for the 75th anniversary last year of D-Day. And that is an experience you'll never forget in your lifetime because you realize what the men and women in this world sacrifice to, you know, make it a decent world again. I mean, I know we have to protest. We have to make changes. It's not the same world as that we knew. People are so defiant. They don't have to like what's going on, but find the right way to fight it. I guess you can tell I'm getting old by my thinking. But I think what Truman said, he said, we've won the war, but we haven't won the peace. And I think that, are we ever going to win the peace? I don't know.
Well, May, good luck to you. Keep on working, and thank you for all you've done.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joe Yazenkovich, and Doug Shugerts. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good day of good news.